Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is William C. Rempel, who spent 36 years as an investigative reporter and editor at the Los Angeles Times. His journalistic honors include an Overseas Press Club Award, a Gerald Loeb Award, and he was a finalist for the Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Journalism. His latest book, Just Ours, is At the Devil's Table, the Untold Story of the Insider Who Brought Down the Cali Cartel. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Rempel.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Ian.
And clearly, the Central and South America has been beset by drug cartels and the power, the enormous, extraordinary financial and political power that they wield. And your story is in large part about the grip, the malignant grip they had on the country of Colombia, and the extent to which how one man brought them down.
Well, that's right. It's about the story of George Salcedo, or Jorge, when he was in Colombia. He was one of the highest insiders to ever turn. He was chief of security for the cartel, for the boss of the bosses, Miguel Rodriguez. And from his vantage point, he was participating in that and seeing the degree of corruption. He passed payments on to police and the police and the justice system, the government, the ministers, prosecutors, businessmen, everyone was beholden to the Cali cartel. They dispensed money the way Halliburton would.
Well, one of the things that I find, there's two ironies in this story. And one is that success in many ways translates as failure, because what happens is with the combination of your character that you profile and Plan Colombia, the billions of the U.S. poured in there and the resources, eventually they broke the back of the cartel and then they moved to Mexico.
Well, that's right.
And now they've taken over Colombia out of Guatemala, and they're moving into Honduras, and they've already suborned apparently the Venezuelan army and God knows where else.
And Mexico is just rife with violence. And it's right. It's an irony that the fall of the Cali cartel, which was a great success. In fact, it's probably the biggest success that the war on drugs can claim in 40 years. That bringing down Cali was an enormous success, and the result is Mexico. The Cali cartel, the remnants of the Cali cartel, the Colombian traffickers ended up becoming wholesalers to the Mexican smuggling gangs. And that's the new reality. And so now there's a major problem in Mexico, and then as you say, in Guatemala and the other countries of Latin America, where the wealth is now being concentrated in smaller countries, where it probably has an even greater danger to suborn the governments and the institutions of those countries.
And the other irony, Bill Rempel, seems to me to be that so much of the violence is meted out against fellow cartel people.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's reached a point of hideousness. You know, particularly the Zetas in Mexico are brutal beyond comprehension, and obviously, you understand why they're paranoid, because that's the strategy, isn't it? To find somebody on the inside to break it, and that it's a corrosive fear that they all have. They don't know who the hell.
Well, that sort of violence has a chilling effect. Yes, there is no better and more certain way to intimidate your employees or your partners than to risk having your beheaded, literally or figuratively. Mm-hmm. And that does keep discipline quite effective.
Right, and your character is—he's watching a guy being slowly strangled with a rope that's being twisted by a stick, and a guy runs by him with some mohawk haircut.
His mullet, yeah.
And saying, "Where's a knife?"
I need a knife. Yeah.
And he's the disemboweler.
Yes,
that's his job.
Well, that's because in the Colombian cartel, like to have their victims disappear. They weren't big on making these big violent statements the way Mexican gangs are or the way Pablo Escobar was. So their MO was you kill them, enforce the discipline. Yes, disembowel them, put them in the river, Cauca River, and they float away and are never seen again. So that's part of the process of making sure the body doesn't float too soon.
But this, of course, in the case of George or Jorge, who I take it you've spent a lot of time with this guy, and even though he's in witness protection.
He's in witness protection, and I could not spend a lot of time with him in person because I don't know where he is.
Right.
He did. Most of our interviews are on the phone. I met him the first time in a courthouse in Miami where he was making an appearance in federal court. And after that, when the book project, he wanted me to sit down with him. He wanted to do this, the first bit of interviewing in person for that. And he arranged on his terms, picked a city, said, go to that city, then tell me where you're staying, and I'll come to you. And so that's how we did it. And I went to the city, and he came to the city. And in the morning of the first he waited. I waited at my room until George came to the door. And it was the beginning of a three-day session where we just worked 18-hour days telling stories. And it was – but over time, I've done about 1,000 hours of telephone interviews. I don't know where he is. I can't go see him. He calls me. It's quite an unusual source relationship. I've never had one like it.
And his story is. I mean, you obviously throughout these many hours, you've got an extraordinary picture of the evolution of a guy. Because we always thought. And I suppose to some extent there was reason to think that the Cali cartel were the gentlemen as opposed to Escobar.
In fact, they prided themselves in being the gentlemen of Cali. Mm-hmm. And that was part of their MOs. They were very careful to work on their reputation. They built police stations in Cali. They gave money to the law school. They held festivals, brought in salsa singers and performed for the city. They owned the local soccer team. Mm-hmm. It was very different. They paid people off, whereas Pablo Escobar killed them. It was a significant difference in style. And they were at war with each other as a consequence, too.
Well, but hadn't Escobar killed Jorge's friend? Because his first job with the Cali cartel was to kill Escobar.
Yeah, well, just a quick thumbnail on George. He was a businessman, a 40-year-old engineer whose jobs were things like, you know, designing forklifts and oil refineries and things like that. And he was but he also was he was in surveillance and intelligence in the Army Reserve. And so in that capacity, he'd met some British mercenaries who wanted to come over and help Colombia rid itself of the FARC and the other insurgents. But because he knew them, the Cali cartel found out about it and said, why don't you bring those guys over to help us kill Pablo? And Pablo was someone who he'd killed a schoolboy, a chum of George. He had been become the Minister of Justice. He'd also set bombs in street corners.
Lara Bonilla was a friend of his, wasn't he?
He was. He and Rodrigo Lara shared a desk in kindergarten, literally.
Yeah.
So they were friends, but everybody in Colombia had lost friends to Pablo. It seemed it was if Pablo targeted the elite of Colombian society and politics, assassinated presidential candidates, and killed judges and police who investigated him. That was not the Cali way. That was Pablo's way. And so for George, it was a patriotic thing to come out and help someone dispose of Pablo.
Again, I'm speaking with William C. Rempel, who spent 36 years as an investigative reporter and editor at the Los Angeles Times. His latest book just out is At the Devil's Table, The Untold Story of the Insider Who Brought Down the Cali Cartel. But, of course, he soon became – I mentioned the story of the guy that was being strangled and then – The disemboweling specialist shows up, but it's very dramatic how he gets out of there, and there's some quite surreal touches there with the DEA have zeroed in on the apartment where the cartel leaders
Well, that's right. In fact,
vault, and then there's some weird little Napoleonic character that shows up.
Well, what happened was George had because he was one of about half a dozen people who knew where Miguel Rodriguez, the boss of the bosses, was holed up, and he led the DEA to that apartment. And when they hit the apartment, they hit it slowly, unfortunately, because they tried to do it that way. They were held up by events and uncooperative locals. But then once they got in, by that time Miguel was in what they call a coleta. It's like a panic room, a little room that you can't tell it's there by any outward sign. They knew eventually where he was in there, but it took hours to figure it out. They were drilling holes in the wall with drill bits, and they were sledgehammering and pounding. And
meanwhile, they broke up in a desk and found
a lot of
good information.
But they also were interrupted by friends of Miguel. The friends of the cartel got word to the a local prosecutor, who sent a man over and said, "Wait a minute! Look, came in a little fellow that they describe as Napoleon. Came in with a little portable typewriter and a case, set it up on the table in the dining room, and started to type up a complaint against the DEA for exceeding the authority of their warrant."
So this is the sort of surreal nature of it, but it also gives you a notion, I think, of how much the justice system had been...
It was corrupt. And that doesn't mean everybody was.
Right.
But when it came time for George to try to get out of the cartel, he knew that he couldn't trust a single Colombian, not because they were all dishonest, but because next to every honest Colombian would be someone who wasn't.
Right.
He knew that there was corruption at every level, and it wouldn't... You know, it just took one person. Like there were a couple of sources that the cartel had inside the elite anti-narcotics team. The pilot who flew General Serrano on raids got his flight training paid for by Gilberto Rodriguez, the other brother of the other godfather. So at all these levels, and they were personal, and they were family, and they were business, there were compromised people in every arena of government and institutions.
So, but he did also manage to get the bookkeeper out, didn't he? I mean, that was a valuable guy.
The accountant for the Cali cartel.
I mean, that's always in the movies. The bookkeeper.
It's always it's the butler and the accountant. The accountant knew everything. I mean, he encoded the entire financial empire of the Cali cartel, and had collected details and on discs and in paperwork and knew what every code meant, and he was the key to being able to bring down the financial empire that did exist, and to identify all the people that were on the payroll. Now, keep in mind that the cartel was paying monthly fees to police on the payroll of $20,000 for locals, $60,000 a month for the national.
But their take was $7 billion or something. So.
$7 billion a year at its peak, yeah. So it was peanuts.
So just in the last minute here, that's just turning to the broader paradox of how the drug cartels have moved over from one country to the other and become and a lot of the leaders of these countries recently met and said that they've got to end the war on drugs. What's the possibility of anything happening here? We got a minute to go.
Well, I don't know the solution to it, except that the wealth is what is the problem. And then whether you find a way to, if you legalize, does that take the wealth out of it? I don't know. But that's what it's going to take. The only way you're going to make a difference is to make sure that the wealth doesn't buy countries like it did in Colombia. Now, so far, Mexico doesn't seem to have that. The fight in the United States going after the crime lords, the crime gangs, does make a difference.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. William Rempel again, 36-year veteran investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times. His latest book, At the Devil's Table, The Untold Story of the Insider Who Brought Down the Cali Cartel. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? We started out with Professor James Galbraith, who's one of the better economists, talking about this extraordinary showdown between the president and the Congress over this completely Republican-generated phony debt ceiling crisis, which, for reasons which I am totally unfathomable, the president has bought into. And, of course, in the president's press conference today, he did at least lay down a marker where if he will veto a bill unless it's for the big deal as opposed to stopgap measures. Whether he can exercise and how he can exercise that leverage was this discussion. And of course, the Professor Galbraith, being an economist, kept saying, well, we're talking about politics, not economics. But the reality is that it's not about economics. The debt ceiling is a phony issue. After all, it is the Republicans who ran up the debt to the extent Bush was the last Bush was responsible for a third, and Bush Senior and Junior and Reagan combined are responsible for over a half. So we're really talking about what was on the table in these in terms of what Obama's prepared to cut, including some of what he calls the Democratic sacred cows. And there, Galbraith really went to town on the idea that we would, that the president would even consider cutting Social Security and Medicare and all of these programs that completely unnecessary and not called for, and the idea that he would be buffaloed into doing this in this phony crisis is really disgraceful. And then we went to London to talk with a veteran reporter, Philip Knightley, about the scandal of that is now being described as Rupert Murdoch's Watergate. And it turns out that they would, Murdoch's minions were digging up dirt on the former British Prime Minister. And the real question is, will the British politicians now feel emboldened enough to stand up to Murdoch, who is the kingmaker over there? He can either make or break them. What was interesting, though, was that the divisions within the Murdoch family, apparently the young Chinese woman that he married is now running off having affairs and taking her chunk of his fortune, and he's defending this horrible woman in Britain because she's kind of a surrogate daughter who's is going to inherit or take care of his business after he's gone, presumably while the Chinese girl tries to grab what she can. So that's that was actually extraordinary to think that Murdoch, who owns Fox News over here, of course, could be in a Watergate situation, because it's pretty hard not to believe that he knew what was going on. That couldn't happen to a nicer guy, what can I say? Then finally, we talked with veteran Los Angeles Times investigative reporter Bill Rempel, who's written a book about the Cali cartel, but we talked really about how the drug trade has infected all of Central and South America, and success in Colombia meant failure in Mexico because they just moved their operations to Mexico. And it's a fascinating tale about an inside guy who they got to break the cartel. But at the end of the day, the war on drugs is a total disaster, and it's destroying all of these countries, and it's fueled by our appetite for drugs here in the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter, and Graham Fitzgibbon, our production intern. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.